This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today we are joined by Tressie McMillan Cottom. Tressie is the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy, published by the New Press. Tressie, welcome.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wonder, before we home in specifically on the book itself, I wonder if you might talk a little bit about your own professional background and the kinds of questions that interest and animate you, maybe as a way to talking about how you arrived at this particular project.
Absolutely. So I am a sociologist by training, but I like to say that my experience of thinking about, you know, sort of those broad sociological questions, right? So what is that point of contact and tension between actor and structure? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that comes as much from who I am as it does from how I have been trained. I tell my students often that I think that any person who has experienced sort of group identity in a way that shapes their day-to-day life experiences in the way that a minority person would in the U.S. has a special sort of lens into thinking about things like structure and agency. Mm-hmm. And I think that is particularly true of me. So I am a North Carolina Southern by birth and by culture and by choice, I like to tell folks. And I come to my questions of understanding of thinking about what inequality means today, right? So as a sociologist, we're very animated by the broad questions of stratification and inequality. I'm very narrowly sort of focused on and most excited about those questions that relate to how is inequality happening now, right? Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of that coming out of my personal experience of thinking about how the new economy certainly shaped my own biography as a somewhat non-traditional student, but absolutely squarely in the great African-American migration story of, you know, middle-class mobility, which I am. But also thinking about how it shaped the lives of people around me and how a lot of that is in flux. But the underlying principles of how inequality happens and how people experience, those seem to be remarkably stable. people. So because of that, I think about the conditions of the new economy, thus the subtitle of the book. And I've thought about it the last few years, specifically related to how it's shaping how we go to school and how we work. Mm-hmm. Right. And especially those handoffs between the two. So we have historically really understood how people go to college as being driven a lot by their expectations of how they will one day work. Well, when the new economy is changing how we work, I ask questions about how that changes how we go to school. Right. So I sort of flipped our understanding of how higher education works. And instead of saying how higher education changes how you go into the economy, I think about how the economy changes how we go to school. And so I ended up doing my graduate study and my dissertation work on for-profit colleges, which I came to because I had personal experience with them. So not only am I African-American or woman, and by virtue of that, I tend to have close social distance to lots of people, other African-Americans and women who disproportionately go to for-profit colleges like the University of Phoenix. I have personal experience with that, but I also have personal experience working in them before I returned to graduate school to become a sociologist. So all of that informs sort of the questions that I ask. You know, what does inequality look like today, and how is it changing some of our fundamental social institutions?
Mm-hmm. So in the book, you're interested not just in describing and examining the functioning of those for-profit or non-traditional colleges, but also in explaining that particular timing of their rise. So I wonder if we could take each of those two things in turn. So what are those institutions at the center of your analysis, the things that you'll often call non-traditional colleges? So what should we know about them, and who are the students who are most likely to be attending them, and what should we know about them too?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing to maybe know about for-profit colleges, first of all, to kind of get out of the way sort of its precise definition, right? Mm-hmm. So the most frequent joke, and if you could help me spread the word to anyone who may ever attend one of my talks and tell them that I've actually heard this joke before. But so I'm doing my talk and and the very first thing you always get from some guy in the audience, and I'm sorry, it's almost always a guy, who says, "Well, aren't all colleges for-profit these days?" Ha, ha, ha. Yes, absolutely right. All schools participate in profit-generating activities, but for-profit colleges, what we're talking about specifically, are those who, by virtue of their tax designation, their IRS designation, can extract profit from the school and distribute that profit to owners. That actually is quite different than how traditional not-for-profits, both public and private, have been allowed to operate by virtue of their tax status. But then what I'm talking about even more specifically than that is those types of schools have actually existed for a very long time. Secretarial schools, technical schools, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But something really particular happened by the mid-1990s up through, I would actually say through last year. We experienced a very different sort of moment with for-profit colleges. The first characteristic of that change is that they became financialized. That means they were operating in the market. They were shareholder-led, mostly by shareholder organizations, a few private equity-owned firms. But that everything about the sort of logics and the assumptions of the culture of finance was guiding how these schools operated and how they had grown. And well, that's actually pretty strange, right? We've never expanded higher education by going to the market before. We usually build community colleges, right, when the get a lot of people, or we build new public schools. So this was actually quite different. And that was specific to sort of this mid-1990s, or what Kevin Kinzer and others, including myself, call this Wall Street era of for-profit colleges. So to think about what that era means for me was a way to understand this particular moment in time that all of us were sort of participating in, but didn't maybe always notice what was going on around us.
Mm-hmm. And so you described them as institutions that are organized to commodify social inequalities. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what you mean by that and how that actually functions in the real world?
Absolutely. So one of my very first tensions was, if these things have always existed, why pay so much attention to them now, right? Yeah. And if they've always existed, then they're not that different really from higher education as we've always understood it. And I actually wrestled with that question a lot. One, in wanting to be fair to my subject matter, but especially wanting to respect the many students that I spoke to, and sort of to respect their decisions and their experience of social mobility, which was to try to really understand this thing as fairly as possible. And what I came to was, yes, this idea that actually what makes, I think, this moment of higher education expansion in the financialized sector different is that it only works if we continue to reproduce, or we continue to produce more people who want social mobility than we do opportunities for social mobility, right? Mm-hmm. And that is different. Traditional not-for-profit higher education, by virtue of the fact that it does not, they are not honor-bound to produce profit every year, can sustain investing more in students than they get out of students, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it is in those institutions' vested interest to produce more opportunities for upward mobility for those students. For-profit colleges actually only become a sustainable business model if we continue to produce people who want higher education or who want social security, a secure labor arrangement, but don't have any other means to get it. And that actually makes them unique and specific. All right, for-profit colleges do not work if we have more equitable distribution of social opportunity. They only work if we remain unequal. Mm-hmm.
So do you see those institutions doing something to ensure that they continue to have a market?
Absolutely. So at a couple of different levels. So at the first level is, like most, you know, organizations these days, they have a very strong lobby that is promoting a set of social policies and also regulations that protect the idea of higher education as an individual good, right? So as long as they can reduce higher education to just a market relationship, they're standing on a particular set of principles, right, that make it very difficult for people to push back against or to critique the quality of the opportunity that they provide. So, you know, that's all that. But, you know, everybody lobbies, right? But they do. They have a very robust lobby. But also at sort of the more concrete level, they are invested in enrolling students who won't be able to figure out the sort of prestige hierarchy of higher education any other way, right? Mm-hmm. So that means selling students on enrolling in the school while walking a very fine line of not explaining to students how college works, right? And that is different. So mm-hmm. when you go to a traditional not-for-profit school, sort of our legitimacy as an institution rests on us helping students to think critically even about our own institution, right? For-profit colleges actually perpetuate sort of the sort of shrouded nature of how higher education isn't equal and how institutions do provide different types of opportunities. But they also promote that to the prospective students themselves, right? So they do not encourage the students to think critically about their own educational choices and opportunities, because to do that would be to jeopardize their profit motive. Mm-hmm. And that is quite different. And so you see that show up in things like how the enrollment officers engage with prospective students when they call a for-profit college, right? That student calls and they have a vague idea that they want to go to school. Well, if they did that at the local community college, granted, it might be difficult for them to get to a counselor. But once they do, that counselor will often say to them, here are some options for you at this school, but here are some other things outside of this school that you should consider, right? There's a program down the street that's offering this new thing, and you should think about that. Or, you know, this could really save you some money if you do it this way. At a for-profit school, the enrollment officer's entire job is actually to not do those things, to not give the student options, right? To narrow their options to something that only that for-profit college can provide, right? And so that's what that looks like on the ground. That's them saying things like, well, you don't know what you want to do with yourself. That's fine. Let's just put you in this business program, because business, everybody likes business. There'll always be jobs in business, right? You'll never go unemployed or up for long if you just have a degree in business. Well, for the student who doesn't know that there's a difference between an MBA from Stanford and an associate's degree in office technology, and they just think all of that is sort of quote unquote business, right? The for-profit college is benefiting from never clarifying that distinction for that student.
Right. But I mean, it feels like it seems to me that throughout the book, you've got a little bit of ambivalence in some ways about these institutions, because on the one hand, they are, I think it is fair to say for most students, giving them what may well be an inferior product at a higher price, if they are leaving them with a product at all when all is said and done, if they wind up actually graduating, getting the certificate or the degree. But on the other hand, they are in fact recognizing a basic reality, which is that education is in fact a mystery to a lot of people, and that navigating the complex bureaucracy of that system, of a local community college or the public institution that I work at, can often be an awful, confounding, infuriating, horrible experience. And if you are trying to manage what is already a complicated life, maybe you've got kids you're raising, you've got a job or two or maybe three, you can't do it, right? So that the for-profit institution is, in fact, recognizing this better in some ways than maybe the institutions you and I work for.
Absolutely. So one of my tensions, and the reason why I think that ambivalence comes through, is me trying, again, so desperately to respect the agency of the students who end up in for-profit colleges, but also with me trying very hard to do something my graduate school advisor used to say to me, you know, Tracy, you know, who's right or wrong is not a sociological question. And I would go, yeah, but it's a good moral, ethical question, right? But it is true that that was me trying to focus on, this is what for-profit colleges have done, right? They have identified a social function, and they absolutely fulfill that social function, right? They did not create the circumstances of the social function. That's the part where I wanted to diffuse responsibility and say, listen, even if we got rid of the University of Phoenix tomorrow, what the economy has produced and what our social policy has produced is a group of people who, by all accounts, even the most conservative estimates, there will be more of these people than there were last year or the year before, who need more training in the labor market, who need more job security and more income security. And the only thing we have offered them is, hey, go to college, with none of the accompanying sort of socialization or support to discern what college would do for them, how to navigate college, or a way to do that without going into significant debt. Yep. The social function then that these for-profit colleges feels, that is real. Right. And for us to focus on getting rid of them, although I say let's regulate them into oblivion, actually won't get rid of the millions of people who go, as one student told me in the book when she got really frustrated with me, well, Tracy, what the hell am I supposed to do? And I thought, well, yeah, she's right. What is she supposed to do? Right. She has followed all of the rules sort of laid out by our current social norms. There was no winning for that student, just like there's no winning for lots of people.
I mean, some of this is geographic, too, right? Is that there are places in which there aren't, you know, state public institutions or local community colleges, and the only accessible institution of education or credentialization is the local for-profit in the mini mall.
That's right. And that was actually really interesting for me to hear. So, like, I talked to a group, and it's particularly one student, sort of her peer group, in a sort of mid-rural North Carolina community. And, you know, the local for-profit college had just as much, if not more, name recognition, sort of institutional trust and affiliation than the local community college, and certainly more than the local private elite residential college that was in the same area, right? Mm-hmm. Students grow up with that name. They grow up knowing people who have gone there, right? They know people who have worked there, and the people who work there sort of, you know, treat them well. They talk to them and remember them. I mean, those things some of us might remember in public higher education, especially. There was a time when we all valued those types of things, and especially at the geographic level. Absolutely. You know, we're living in a time when we're paying suddenly a lot of attention to the sort of geographic inequalities in our country and how much those intersect with income and wealth inequalities. And yeah, there are huge swaths of this country where there is not any other practical, affordable credentialing opportunity. Yeah. Technology can't solve that. Probably only social policy and intense directed public investment can, but that's not the moment we're in. That's a political non-starter.
Right. Because it would be expensive and it would serve a population that doesn't have any political power.
That's right. Nobody cares about the fact that there are a whole bunch of poor people or working class people in these sort of middle rings. You know, they're not quite totally rural, but they're not urban either. These middle rings throughout the country who, thanks to years of things like transportation policy, job and economic policy, racial policy, and sort of the gendered racial type of changes that have shaped the labor market, have no other option. These people, even if they do vote, tend to be in disproportionately gerrymandered districts where their vote doesn't carry the same weight. They do not have political representation to say to them, to say to those in power, we're worth this investment. Yeah, they're literally trapped in those inner rings.
And this is Stephen Pimper. I'm the host of the Public Policy Channel here on the New Books Network, and we are speaking with Tressie McMillan Cottom about her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy, published by the New Press. So Tressie, you do not yourself make these kinds of arguments from this framework, but I'm sort of hearing you talk, I'm wondering whether there is sort of a neo-Marxist structural argument to be made about what you're just describing, and that well, this is functional in a lot of ways, right? This is in fact serving we shouldn't be surprised by the fact that the political system is not responding. This is actually a way of dealing with a problem. We've got a population who we don't particularly give a damn about whether they get access to upward mobility and don't necessarily have a place for them if they get meaningful credentials, because we've got sort of labor problems across the board. And this is a means by which we create the illusion of that upward mobility while using them as an extractive resource and funneling that money off into another segment of the population we're more concerned with. What do you think about that kind of argument?
That is actually the argument that you just pointed out to me that I may not have made it well then. But yes, because that's absolutely the argument, Stephen, that is exactly what has happened, right? So there's nothing surprising about the fact that this is how capital works, right? That what we do have, the conditions of the new economy that have changed how we work has also changed how capital flows work. And so that means that extracting value from the public sector for private profit is pretty much about the only way for profit to be made at the type of scale with which financialized capital now operates. And the only way you're going to find those things are to find the pockets of the public sector where there's still significant investment. As it turns out, we only have a couple of things left, right? Healthcare, which is why Medicare and Medicaid continue to come up as highly politically contentious issues, and higher education, which is why broadly things like student debt has become this sort of public discussion. It's because those are really the only places left for capital seeking and the rentier class to sort of invest in to extract resources. That it has to go through poor people, there's nothing new about that, right? This is just a particular iteration of how that resource extraction now happens, given that we have reduced the sort of size of the state in some of these ways to such a narrow pinpoint that there are only a couple places left to go.
So we've talked a lot sort of about the macro, the structural issues. I wonder if we can sort of flip around a little bit and maybe do a little bit more of the ethnography. Could you talk just a little bit either as through the prism of your own experience working in two different, very, very different for-profit colleges, or during your research, talk about some of the people you met and their stories and their own experience and how that might help listeners sort of make sense of why people make these choices and how they make their choices.
Sure. I think I spent a total of 2 years working in for-profit colleges. One was a beauty college. The other was a technical college. And I argue in the book that this is a way to actually understand sort of the macro aspect through observing people, right? Mm-hmm. That I was dealing, those were two vastly different student populations. At the beauty college, it was overwhelmingly female, disproportionately African-American. In the time that I was at the beauty college, I enrolled one man and maybe something like a couple of hundred women, right? Mm-hmm. So this was absolutely about a certain type of gendered labor, gendered low-income service labor, the people that we tend to think of as being for-profit college students.
Right.
But the other end of the spectrum were the people who are increasingly becoming more likely to be a for-profit college student. Those are the people who are completing a degree, getting a master's or a graduate degree. And these days, everything between a PhD in psychology, clinical psychology, to a Juris Doctorate in law. And that population at the technical college looked quite different, right? I saw many more men, more white men in particular, even though there were class differences, I was more likely to see working class men who were trying to move up the status ladder into professional labor at the technical college. But those populations were very different, but they acted so similar. And that was my first sort of, well, how is that, mm-hmm. right? As sociologists especially, we don't think about white men of any class position having a whole lot in common with poor working class women,
yeah.
black women of color or women of color, right? But they were remarkably similar in their understanding of mobility, their aspirations, and the choices that they had available to them. And I thought, well, now that's interesting and that's different. How can I understand that? Well, to understand that, I thought about the people that I had met in those two places, and that sort of informed my question, right? And then I spent some time talking to students in for-profit colleges. I enrolled in 9 for-profit colleges in a large urban metropolitan area in the U.S. South, as we say these things, get an understanding of what those decisions look like day to day, right? So that means hanging outside of for-profit colleges, talking to students as they come and go. I would point out to people that these days, you know, for-profit businesses, we don't have a right to be on their campus in the way we would a public or private not-for-profit. So I was always skirting the law just a little bit. And so, you know, I try to hang out and affect looking like a prospective student. I talked to a lot of women, which is not uncommon. You know, they were more likely to speak to me. But I tried really hard to find men as well. And the stories they told me were stories that were about time having become such a precious commodity and resource. In many ways, men were experiencing sort of that feminized relationship to time that has long been true of women working the second shift, right, of managing the family life in addition to the work life. What's happened is that for a lot of men, increasingly, they're experiencing some dimensions of that, right? They maybe are taking on more childcare or family tasks. And because of that, are having to make remarkably similar sort of educational choices as have always been the sort of constraints on women, which is how do I fit college around all of those other aspects of my life?
Yeah.
I found that students were really proud of themselves and how hard they were working. They resisted the idea that they go to a low status institution. And their resistance of that idea really got in the way of them understanding things like debt and any sort of predatory behaviors as being predatory,
right?
In fact, many of the students, especially the women that I talked to, saw the debt as a sign of legitimacy and not as a problem for moral concern, right? And this reimagines how we then have to think about things like organizing these students for those who work on such things or reaching out to them. You can't start with this, hey, you're being, you know, you're prey in this system of predatory higher education, which so much of our research in social science on for-profits have been about. Characterizing these students as these sort of passive entities that are being abused, well, that was the exact wrong way to start. They are proud of what they're doing. They are working hard, and in many ways, they resent that their hard work is not transparent or can't be translated to gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that language, at least as much as I'm familiar with it, also either explicitly or implicitly operates from the assumption that these students are stupid, right? That they are not capable of getting into a more legit institution. What is your experience about whether that's true or not?
Absolutely not true. And even if it were, which is what I tried to argue in the book, even if it were that, and again, it is not true.
Yeah.
But if you ever really want to get me started, I have resisted that idea and I get very angry about it because, again, the people enrolled in for-profit colleges are disproportionately people of color and women. Yeah. Right. And so you're really compounding this historical narrative of the mental inferiority of African-Americans and women when you say that. But even if I were to accept the premise of that argument, that explains people who have no experience with higher education who maybe attend something like the beauty college. It becomes a whole lot harder to say that of somebody who's doing a master's or doctorate degree at Walden, who has a traditional bachelor's degree. That's why I spent so much time talking to women who were in exactly that position to sort of refute the idea that they are stupid, have low cognitive functioning, as one article says about them. Granted, it's an econ article, and I know they're constrained by their language. But still, you know, this idea that prestige reflects the cognitive ability of the students in the institution, right? These were people who have traditional bachelor's degrees from institutions, traditional not-for-profit institutions, many of them the same institutions that produce people like you and I. Yeah. They're clearly, by our standards, not stupid. So then we have to have another way to understand their educational choices. And it came down to things like gender division of labor, racist and sexist career opportunities in different career ladders in mostly predominantly gendered occupational fields like healthcare and education. And that, again, the time with which we increasingly encourage people or require people to invest in staying labor market ready does not in any way offset the time they still have to invest in managing all of their other social responsibilities, yeah. Parent, spouse, et cetera. And so they're not stupid. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of, I mean, it's, I'm trying to find a polite way to say this. I have been present in a number of institutions that do a terrible job recognizing and meeting the needs of non-traditional students, right? Of students who may be older, who maybe have family responsibilities, who may be caring for siblings or for parents or for other relatives, who may have very complicated lives in addition to their own necessity to work. I mean, I've been in a lot of institutions that get very smug about their expectations of students and do very little to understand how the university could better serve their needs.
Right.
And it seems to me that some of these non-traditional institutions at least get that and maybe exploiting it in ugly, horrific kinds of ways, but do in fact have a deeper understanding of those students as people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And have done more to understand their prospective student. Again, their motivations for doing so are absolutely about profit.
Yeah.
But this is what I say to traditional institutions. If we want to retain our moral high ground on disparaging for-profit colleges, we're going to have to compete for the students they serve.
Yeah.
And if we don't do that, then I really am not interested in sort of how we disparage for-profits. And in that way, I think I tend to be a bit odd because, yes, absolutely. We can beat for-profit colleges on every dimension of serving their likely student. We have not done so.
There's one other kind of student that I think it might be worth talking about a little bit, and I've forgotten the young man's name. He's a graduate of Morehouse College. You ran into him and a buddy of his. Could you talk a little bit about sort of the degree that he was getting and why he was getting it?
Oh, Mike. Yes, his name is Mike. And truly just one of those wonderful moments that happens when you're doing field work. I truly stumbled upon him, overheard a conversation that he and his buddy were having at the mall. Right. They're shopping in the middle of a business day. Granted, I was too, but still.
Yeah.
And so that says a lot. Right. They're out in the middle of the workday and they were shopping and they were young men and they had young black men and they're having a conversation that my ears immediately pick up on in the parking deck because he's telling them, yo, man, nah, don't worry about it. I got a girl who will give you all of the tests and the papers. You just got to do the enrollment and stuff. You just got to get enrolled. And I was like, what? What was it talking about? All right, so I'm here for this. And so I kind of start eavesdropping and we end up talking actually several times over a few months. And I'm actually still in touch with one of the young men in that conversation. Mike is just quintessential Atlanta, in which in my parlance means he's quintessential black upward mobility, right? He has all of the trappings of sort of black social mobility in one person. He was perfect. He was youngish. At the time that we first started talking, he was just turning 30. He had attended an elite, historically black college, Morehouse, that is known for coming as close as a black institution is ever allowed to do to being sort of being comparable to a traditional predominantly white institution. He had sort of overcome sort of some of the cultural limitations. He came from Black working class parents, the type that would have been common to his generation, which was they worked in the public sector. So they had good, secure jobs, but ones that we would still probably maybe consider working class. And so he had changed his his class position in many ways. And so I say to him when we're talking, you know, so what is that about? After he tells me about his, you know, his dreams, he plans to start a tech company and has met all of these friends who are going to incubate, he uses words like incubate and pitch, you know, one of these young men. So he's fully embraced what I call the entrepreneurial ethos of the new economy, which is that we all need to now be entrepreneurs, right? Yeah. Which is a cultural concession to the idea that the labor market will no longer provide for the health and well-being of its employees. Right. We are all supposed to act like we're always looking for our next job. Well, you know, that's exhausting. But a young man like Mike had totally embraced this, in part because a place like Institution is aspirational and entrepreneurial, and they had encouraged him to embrace it. The problem is, in embracing the idea didn't change any of Mike's sort of status culture and the wealth and income inequalities that had shaped his life chances that he wasn't always able to articulate. So, for example, what he was really going to school for was to access capital. Yeah. That was what the conversation was about, the financial aid system. He's a young Black man who wants to start his own business. How does a young Black man get capital to start a business? Well, the literature can tell you he doesn't. Right? Because you mostly are supposed to get capital from your parents. Well, we know the history of racist wealth inequality and extraction for African Americans in the U.S., and that is highly unlikely to happen. So, you know, 10 years prior, when we were in a different credit market, he might have used credit cards. Well, that market is also pretty much dried up. Mm-hmm. He may have tapped into his parents' home equity. Well, guess what? African Americans live in communities where one of the first things that got hit in the housing crisis was their home equity, their greatest asset. His parents were similar. They lived out in Lithonia, which is how you say it in Atlanta, in Lithonia, Georgia, and where lots of middle-class, working-class African-Americans live. And so they didn't have the ability to do that. What Mike was looking for was capital. Man. Well, what he knew, having come from an aspirational higher education background, was that, yeah, they'll always give you money if you're in school, as he told me. So you keep going to school to get access to some money. He was relying on the federal student loan system to give him a federal student loan refund, right? Because if you're poor enough, then you can sometimes get a refund from your student loan, which is meaning they've lent you in excess of your tuition balance. And he and his buddy were going to use that money for his business. Well, then that means they needed to make school as an efficient, a technical process as possible. So they had tapped into this underground market of people who sold and shared the coursework for online classes and online degree programs, right? For-profit colleges are particularly well-suited for this for a couple of structural reasons. They use centralized curriculum development, meaning the faculty don't design the courses. A centralized office does, and they ship it out to those faculty. Meaning even if the faculty changes or you take the course with someone else, the chances are high that the coursework, the test, the homework, all of that is the same.
All the same.
So this creates a market for that kind of work that makes it actually quite rational that these young men that I talked to that day would use the system in that way.
I can sort of, you know, hear in the back of my head the people who would jump to sort of call, well, that's fraud. That's...
Yeah.
But fine, call it fraud, right? But I mean, you're talking about, again, we're talking about smart, ambitious folks who live in very constrained circumstances, taking advantage of who are trying to sort of live up to the aspirations of the culture that tells us who they should be, who aren't simultaneously sort of given access to the tools to do that, sort of using this really sort of smart, clever kind of way to get access to what a lot of people might think of as relatively small bits of money. I mean, he was talking about, what, $5,000-$7,000 a year or something.
That's right.
Like that.
Yeah, that's important. We're not talking about, this is how wealth deprived many people are in the U.S., but especially African Americans. Yeah. $5,000 to $7,000, especially to get, as they kept saying to me, lump sum, meaning, you know, all at one time, was a huge financial boon. I mean, we are not talking about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg money from the, you know, the Winkle people wins, right? We're not talking that kind of money, Stephen. We're talking about, you know, not enough to even really pay your rent in a place like Atlanta, you know? And so, yeah, we're talking about relatively small pockets of money. And, you know, I get into the moral issue about extracting money, using that student loan money for non-higher education related things. And I go, well, first of all, being economically secure is a higher education related expense, mm-hmm. right? Especially if your family, if you don't come from family resources. That's number one. Number two, I mean, you know, let's just back off of the moral high ground a little bit here. We all use our institutional access to do these kinds of things all the time. It's just that for many white people, especially middle class and upper class white people, the social institution that they extract from tends to be their family. Right. And that's outside of the realm of sort of the legal and moral systems of legitimacy or deviance. Right. But it's the same activities. And so, yeah, you know, it's only moral. There's a great quote from someone whose name I'm now blanking on, who says, you know, really what we're saying when people take on debt that we don't agree with is they didn't deserve the opportunity that they took the debt on for.
So this is Stephen Pimper. I'm the host of the Public Policy Channel here at the New Books Network, and we are talking with Tressie McMillan Cottom about her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. So Tressie, you talked a little bit earlier about lessons that other institutions might learn from the behavior of these non-traditional for-profit colleges and the kinds of political and social changes that would need to take place to eliminate the opportunities that for-profit colleges have to exploit folks. I wonder if you might take a few minutes and just sort of think out loud for our listeners about maybe putting some of those pieces together. What should the policy agenda be for limiting the ability of these institutions to exploit people?
Absolutely. So I actually in many ways thought about that way more than I thought I was going to think about when I first started this, you know, way back when, because I kept running into the same dead ends I'm sure social policy folks are very familiar with going, this seemed really easy when I started, right? And it just would get more and more complicated the more you would disentangle something. And what I fundamentally came away with was this belief. The best higher education program is a jobs program. Mm-hmm. We have sort of shunted higher education policy off to this sort of weird space between K through 12 policy and sort of workforce, this term workforce development. Mm-hmm. And really, it is a fundamental economic social policy issue. And that's what debt, I think, is increasingly exacerbating. And so we need to understand that, you know, college and higher education, which I believe, by the way, is absolutely about more than its job function. Yeah. I believe in that. I believe in it so much that I won't ask higher education to do what economic policy is supposed to do, right? Which is to provide social mobility and a quality of life for American workers. So I think the first thing, I've been really encouraged by social movements that are organizing to improve job quality, because a lot of this is a result of the labor market shunting off the responsibility of employer security to higher education. And higher education, for all of the sort of rhetoric out there about us being sort of the elites, we really don't have the power to push back against the labor market. We derive too much of our legitimacy from it. So because of that, we keep taking on that responsibility for something we really can't do. And so we need social movements. I say that higher education people who truly believe in education as being more than just a functional good and job training need to be very committed to social movements right now. They're going to save us. That's things like Fight for 15. Mm-hmm. You know what? Most of the, especially those women who were disproportionately in programs like those at the beauty college, what they really wanted was a good job.
Yeah.
They didn't want to go to school.
Right.
Well, that's about job quality, right? And so groups like Fight for 15, which is overwhelmingly led by African-American Latina women who are out there fighting to improve the quality of service jobs that are, you know, the majority now of our labor market, are hugely important to sort of alleviating demand for for-profit colleges. Then on the flip side of that, for the people who are going back to places like the technical school, is how do we push back against the idea that the only way to navigate jobs in the new economy that, again, we are all always need to be prepared to lose is not for us to continue to always send people back to college when inevitably the job lets them go, right? The downsizing happens or the labor market shifts. There has to be a public option. I tend to be a fan of a federal jobs program because I do believe in the social function of work and the social value of work and the fact that there's plenty of work that needs to be done in our society that the private sector is just not interested in providing because it's not necessarily profitable. That doesn't mean the work doesn't need to happen. And in fact, putting that kind of floor beneath the labor market is the biggest thing we could do to alleviate the demand and that for-profit colleges take advantage of. Then on the sort of institutional level, I think traditional not-for-profit higher education has to challenge head on. You know, some institutions do this. I think about things, places like Southern New Hampshire University was one of the first to ever run an ad campaign that said explicitly, we are not a for-profit college, and let us tell you why that matters. Right. And I thought, yes, thank you. Say that. Right. We sort of have this, you know, leftover from sort of our golden era of higher education, this sort of, you know, cultural ideal that we don't talk about those things. Well, as the potential, the higher education market, student market has diversified, we can't assume that students know those types of things. We're going to have to speak more explicitly about how the prestige hierarchy works, even if that means admitting that we're not all Harvard, right? It really is fine that we're not, and we need to kind of get over that, and we need to say explicitly what we are. We need to make an affirmative case for not-for-profit higher education for students who do not come to us with that already inculcated in them from their parents and their social networks.
So as we work our way toward the end of the time here, Tressie, so what else are you working on? What are the other kinds of questions swimming around in your head and maybe ideas for next projects?
I'm not the person that ever has a problem of not enough ideas. I have the opposite problem and I'm working on that. So we've narrowed down to a couple of things. One, both really stemming out of this work, even though I think it's not always transparent how until I explain it to some people. So thanks for giving me a chance to do that, because I think of these things as being all very much interrelated. So a lot of what was driving the labor market conditions that created the sort of perfect storm for for-profit colleges in the Wall Street era was that we've just got an issue of how technology is changing how we work, right? And so I continue to be interested in how technology is shaping our social institutions precisely because it tends to produce the conditions for exploitative private market operations. And those and that extraction always comes for people of color first. Mm-hmm. So for me, looking at those things through a race, class, gender lens just makes sense, right? In the same way that starting the conversation about for-profit colleges to think about Black women made sense because, again, that's where sort of the most of sort of the weaknesses in the intersecting institutions usually show up. So right now, I'm thinking about things like, how is technology shaping how people look for work? And so I'm looking at this sort of marginal moving from for-profit credentials, which were at least in the formal realm of credentialing, to thinking about things that are less formal. So things like boot camps, these coding boot camps, these sort of on-demand, short-term, I call it the wild, wild west of credentialing happening out there right now. Again, fed mostly by a lot of private equity investment, just like the for-profits, and also by existing in sort of the shadow space of regulation, and also relying upon, again, the fact that more people want opportunities than we can actually provide them. And so I'm following a group of workers around who have who are participating in or have participated in coding boot camps and thinking about how those do and do not work. We actually know nothing about them. We're throwing all this money at them. We know nothing about them, really. And so I'm doing that project. And the other project is sort of my big overarching project. I've been told that this is a life project, and we'll see if I live long enough to do it. I'm really interested in getting in, and can't believe there's sort of not like a definitive book out there to explain how race, class, and gender shapes technology as sort of a macro system, right? So when these technological changes are shaping social institutions, in which ways are they also shaping our understanding of how race, class, and gender work? And so I am collecting literature and ideas about that right now. I'm probably thinking about looking at that across the major social institutions. So work, education, family, and religion. And we'll see how that goes.
So nice small set of questions.
Exactly. Exactly. nothing major that other people haven't, attempted and failed mightily.
So that's great. So we'll look for a book on that in what, 2 years' time? How's that sound?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. 2 years, 20, somewhere.
So finally, before we sign off, Tressie, so before we started recording today, we chatted a little bit about sort of the current political moment that we inhabit, and talked about sort of spaces where we might be able to see hope and opportunity more broadly, but particularly for the populations that you and I are both interested in, for poor and low-income people who may be particularly squeezed in a number of different ways. Is there anything sort of that you think might be productive to talk about as it relates to your thinking or to your work about where we might see spaces for hope?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, we are in an interesting moment, right? So the day after the election, I called my editor, who's going to love me for this, and I begged them, because we were already in publication, please, please let me add something about the election. And so we did. We did eke in a few pages there at the very end. And most of that was me trying to say, one, that is as despondent as I was, that I thought it makes the case even more strongly for how important and valuable social movements and organizing are going to be. I take so much, I get so much by way of sort of emotional fortitude and hope from things like Black Lives Matter, Fight for 15, and Strike Debt. These are social movements with a lot of young people, yes, but not just young people, who I think are attending to the populations that got lost in this presidential election. Working class people of all races, and understanding that when we talk about class, we're also talking about race and gender, right? The idea that unions are over, absolutely not. There have been some significant union wins over the last few years. It's just they're not coming from people that we think of as being union people, right? They're coming from service workers, women, maids, fast food workers. And I take a tremendous amount of hope from them, because it shows that organizing does still matter, especially at the local and the state level, which is where I think this fight has to kind of happen at this point, especially if we're looking at a moment where we can fully expect a ratcheting down of federal oversight of almost everything, judging by where we are right now. Something that people who disagree with me ideologically have known for at least 30 years is that the real fights are going to be at the local and the state level. And these social movements have understood that. I have been dismayed by public discourse around Black Lives Matter, but emboldened by the fact that they have embraced academic research and policy work and have put out one of the most sophisticated policy platforms of any young people's
social
movement.
Their economic analysis, really deep, smart, powerful stuff that nobody even knows exists.
I couldn't believe that nobody wasn't making a big deal. I mean, it was amazing, right? Yeah. I'm so excited about that and want to support that as much as I can. I mean, oh my God, I signed that platform in all of my classes, and my students go, "We didn't know that was a thing." I mean, just really trying to put that before as many people as possible. But I take a lot of hope from that. And again, I think we'll look up in 20, 30 years, and we will owe a lot to our professional selves, higher education people, faculty, academics. We will owe a lot of our professional selves to these movements.
Absolutely. Thank you for that.
No problem. Thank
We've
you.
We've been speaking with Tressie McMillan-Cottom about her new book from the New Press called Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Tressie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Stephen. Truly, for me too, really. I needed this moment, as you and I talked about a little earlier before we got started. It's been a great bright spot in some difficult days. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you. Take care.